it really invoked fear and adrenaline and faster heart rate. And to be one of the participants in the game, I think is going to be pretty special.
Virtual reality is big business. Facebook have invested $2 billion into the technology, and this week on Download This Show, we get our very first hands-on with Sony's PlayStation VR.
VR has been around for a long, long time, but now we're starting to come to fruition.
Is it the future of gaming? Will it make you throw up? The answer to both of those questions is almost definitely yes. And would you pay for YouTube? They've unveiled their brand new subscription service, Red, and don't like the new government scheme to hold your metadata for 2 years? Well, you know who hates it more than you, your internet service provider. Get set to find out why. This is your guide to the week in technology, the internet, and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. And it is a very big welcome to our panelists this week. Welcome back, Claire Riley from CNET.
Thank you, Mark.
And we have a new panelist this week. He's a man with a storied history in Australian media, a one-time journalist, creator of the channel World Movies, supplementing the erotic nightmares of an entire generation of young men. He's got a very long history in both subscription and community television. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Internet Australia, which is a chapter of the global non-profit Internet Society. Laurie Patton, welcome to Download This Show.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
I feel like I just read out your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, it was impressive.
Don't forget, you can tweet along with the show. The hashtag is, as always, Download This Show. A little bit later in the program, we are crossing to Paris Games Week. We're talking to the head of Sony PlayStation in Australia, Mike Ephraim, to see the reaction to the new PlayStation VR. New games, new experiences, new forms of nausea. Is it worth it? Make sure you stay listening for that. But first, YouTube. Last week, YouTube unveiled what is... it's almost like an attempt to take on both Netflix and Spotify in one go, amongst other things. It's a new subscription fee. They're calling it YouTube Red, and you pay... in essence, Claire Riley, to avoid ads.
That's it. It's suddenly this kind of two-tier system. We thought YouTube was the internet video for all, but now there are going to be some people that are more equal than others. That's, you know, not exactly how it works.
The gradual animal farming
of
the internet.
Even though this is an entirely capitalist proposition. Essentially, what you can do is pay roughly $10 a month, and that will give you a kind of a filtered YouTube that doesn't have the pre-roll ads that you get at the start. It might not have pop-ups. It might not have all that stuff that kind of makes YouTube what we know. So it becomes much more of a video media streaming channel, which is kind of what YouTube's become in recent years. It's become less of that sort of, oh, watch a short clip of a cat video, to an actual distribution platform for, you know, pop stars, for movie studios, for content creators.
All right, there's a few more other things you get with that subscription fee, but I do want to start with that central proposition, Laurie, of would you pay to avoid ads on YouTube at the moment?
That's a really interesting question, and it brings up a cultural divide. So Foxtel this next month is about to celebrate 20 years. In 1995, a whole bunch of cable guys from America came out here and told us that they expected we'd have household penetration like they do, around the 80 or 90%. Foxtel's never got past
like 30-odd percent,
yeah. 30%. So the question is, are Australians quite happy to pay money to see things? Or are Australians quite happy to have ads and get it for nothing? We just don't know.
And there's also that additional issue of this constant like subscription upon subscription now, where you've got a generation of people that are paying for Spotify, they're paying for Netflix, they're paying for, you know, standard, you know, and eventually you do sort of reach this point where there's a lot. I actually looked at my credit card statement the other day, and there's a lot of subscriptions I'm lined up for. You know, the beauty, I guess, of the Foxtel era was that you'd kind of pay this one set fee and you get all these channels. Now you've got an a la carte system where you're paying for lots of different things. I was just thinking the value proposition of what you get back from YouTube, I don't know that it's that great. Now, there's some other functions in there as well we should mention. You will be able to download videos, watch them offline as well. Why would I want that?
Have you seen the Bad Blood video clip, Mark? I want to watch that like seven times.
But then watch it seven times so she gets her seven views, Taylor Swift.
Yeah, look, maybe this is something for people who are really into streaming of things like live plays, like a Let's Play kind of situation. So one of the biggest YouTube stars is PewDiePie. He has made a living out of screaming down a microphone and telling people what he loves about playing particular video games. Maybe you want to watch that kind of Let's Play over and over again. Or maybe some of the longer content that you can get on YouTube, you can get, download and watch on your phone. I think, though, you're right, with the all the subscriptions we have, $10 doesn't seem like much, but that's how all of these services sell themselves. It's just 10 bucks a month. Suddenly, when you have it's just 10 bucks a month for your YouTube, Netflix, Stan, Presto, Spotify, RDO, you're paying a lot of money.
Mm. Is it also a little bit like the problem that newspapers have had, which is that they've spent years being an ad-supported business online, which has set the expectation that the value proposition in the mind of the audience is that this is worth nothing because there's ads, and I don't feel like suddenly, you know how we've trained newspaper audiences online to expect something for free, and it's been really hard to kind of change that mentality of putting things behind a paywall. Is there a similarity between the two?
I think there's a generational thing.
Yeah, right.
You know, my teenage sons are used to paying for things. They don't see that as quite the same transaction as older people who are used to getting free television. It will come down to a question of how many things you want. And we've got all these video on demand platforms, and I've been arguing for some time now that there isn't room for three of them.
Yeah.
Are you going to pay for something else on top of all of that?
One of the things YouTube is also putting behind their new paywall is original programming. And you mentioned PewDiePie earlier. PewDiePie will be teaming up with one of the producers of The Walking Dead, which is, of course, one of the biggest shows in the world, to create some kind of horror show. Now, there is a sizzle reel.
It will
reel.
Be a horror show. That is correct, Mark.
Yeah, the sizzle reel looks really terrible to me, but then I kind of got into a conversation with people I know who kind of live off YouTube, where they actually make their money as YouTube subscribers, and they basically said, look, the heart of YouTube is very much about the people that make kind of DIY content. It's less about, you know, the production values of big TV shows don't necessarily work on YouTube. It's about that one-to-one connection that they have with these YouTube stars, these huge people like Lily Singh and PewDiePie and, you know, Troye Sivan and all those sorts of people, and perhaps I'm looking at it through the wrong lenses.
I think that's right. Like, I think maybe all of us in this room are kind of coming at it from that legacy model of, okay, I'm going to watch the Star Wars trailer on there. I can watch some trailers. I can watch a funny, like, mobile phone content. But what we're missing is this whole range of stuff. And I think it's really popular with the Gen Y and millennials of, like, makeup tutorials or funny, like, people doing their own sketch comedy. I mean, we saw the Australian group Skitbox. Their activewear video absolutely exploded. It went around all around the world. They're the kind of group that are making videos and then pushing them out on YouTube. There's a lot of those people doing that. So I think a younger generation is really seeing this as a kind of a platform to get yourself out there. You don't need a full studio. You can just have a pretty lo-fi setup, and people are going to really gravitate towards that.
I'm particularly interested in a shift at the moment that we're seeing very clearly in the US, which is millennials that are cord cutters, people that are cutting their cable TV connection, or a generation coming through that are never going to sign up to cable. And this and Netflix and certainly Stan in Australia seem really aimed at that kind of market. Now, as a guy that's has an amazing history with subscription television, what do you think the future of the classic cable scenario is?
Okay, so the thing that you need to remember is that cable television in America is older than any of us. It started in the 1940s, and it started in Philadelphia, where the mountains got in the way of the signal and people couldn't get a decent free-to-air signal. Most Americans have cable TV in order to get free-to-air TV. Mm. So we've already got a fabulous free-to-air service, and so the millennials are not used to having to pay to get 100 channels. They pay for the stuff they want, and that's a really fundamental difference.
And there's also the fact that we came into digital, and suddenly there's a lot of terrible channels that came with digital TV, but we suddenly got more choice. So free-to-air with the whole Freeview project, that really brought a lot more choice to consumers. And now we're still seeing new channels launching. So SBS has got their food channel launching soon, which I am going to be tuned to, plugged into 24 hours a day.
On behalf of the multicultural broadcaster, we thank you.
Yes.
Then Nine have launched a lifestyle channel on one of their channels.
They're all going continuously live. And I have to say that Television Sydney that I created has been doing that since 2009.
That's right. So they're live streaming now, but the community channel, Television Sydney, in terms of just the data costs involved in that, how did Television Sydney sustain that?
Well, they're very lucky. They have a benefactor called the University of Western Sydney.
Uh-huh. Are there going to be any problems, though, when we start to, oh, this is such a dry topic, but have spectrum allocation. Everyone loves talking about spectrum allocation, am I right, guys?
Laurie's very vocal about
it. I can make that really exciting. Now, unfortunately, the current government is about to kill community television by taking their spectrum away from them, and I really think it's going to be a battle for community channels to be found in this mass of stuff that's out there on the web.
But it's also that really vexed position, because you've got interesting community channels that have always worked off TV, but some of them are really savvy and they've been online. As we go to more over-the-top services, people are going to traditional TV less, and we need more bandwidth and we need more capability to actually carry those over-the-top services, so we need the spectrum. So it's this kind of...
Well, see, here we have an interesting dilemma. We have a new Prime Minister who is allegedly digital savvy, but the previous Prime Minister actually said he wasn't prepared to build a broadband network just so people could watch TV.
Right.
When in actual fact, it turns out that it is going to be one of the things that people really do want from a broadband network.
Yeah, guess what, Tony? Kind of missed that one.
Yeah.
All right. We are talking to Laurie Patton from Internet Australia and Claire Riley from CNET. My name is Mark Fennell, and this is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. And ISPs are very unhappy at the moment. They're unhappy because of mandatory data retention. Of course, the new rules are that they have to keep your metadata, all the communication around your communication for 2 years. But the ISPs are angry now. Laurie, why are they angry?
So our concern is not just for the ISPs. It's actually for internet users who will end up paying for all of this in increased internet access fees.
The key thing here is that the government is going to pay, reimburse them the money, but they're going to do it in two tranches. And the first one is a lot smaller than the ISPs were expecting. So they're going to be out of pocket is the main issue.
We don't know how much they're going to get in each of the two different tranches. The other thing is it's only for their setup costs. It's not their ongoing costs. So even if they get some money up front, they're out of pocket to begin with, and then they're continuously out of pocket for the rest of their lives.
So when that happens, that's basically when we as consumers are going to end up to pay for metadata in the long run.
Have you ever known a big telco to absorb costs?
No, it wouldn't strike me as a thing that they would do by nature.
And the other problem is the big telcos won't absorb, but the smaller ones will collapse, and so we'll have less choice, so the larger players will be more likely to, you know, just set the standard.
Can you paint a picture of me of the kinds of ISPs we're talking about? Because you mentioned ones with less than 10 staff. How many of these are there in Australia, and where do they operate?
There are around about 400 ISPs, we believe. The large number of those would be an organisation that already does some kind of IT service, particularly in regional areas. Mm. So they're the people you go to buy your computer. They're the people who go to your house and help set it up if you don't know how to. They're the people who organise for you to get the internet, and they're the people you ring on Sunday afternoon when it doesn't work.
Mm. And so they're reselling major services, so they'd be like a secondary seller. So they're using a well-known network, perhaps. So that's how a mobile virtual network operator works. So you've got the likes of Kogan, they're reselling SIM cards and they're reselling kind of cheap access to mobile.
But and they're piggybacking on a larger network.
They're piggybacking off Vodafone. So they're using Vodafone's call centres, Vodafone's networks, the idea being that you get the power of the big player, but you get the agility of a small player.
So in that instance, is it Kogan's job to collect the metadata, or is it still Vodafone's job to collect the metadata?
No, it comes down to the individual ISP, and that's one of the areas where there's massive confusion as to how much it can actually be kind of subcontracted out. The other issue is, where is it going to be stored? Is it going to be stored in data centres in Australia? Is it going to be sent overseas?
Are there rules around that in legislation?
No,
is there any clarity on that?
No, and look, there is an argument that it's, you know, security is security no matter where it is, but there are countries, and America is one of them, where once the data is dumped anywhere in a data center in America, the Americans say, we are entitled to have access to it.
And so you get a whole bunch of national security questions. If we're talking about national security government, why don't we discuss that ISPs such as IONET have said it's cheaper to get data storage overseas? One of the places they'd look to go is China. There are, you know, you can expect that security and your personal information would be perhaps safe from hackers, or they're going to look after their data centers. It's not going to be a shoddy operation, but we need to start questioning about exactly what Laurie said there. If you're storing information, really, really personally identifiable information, let's not get to the furphy that metadata is just the information around your serious content. You can identify a lot about a person through metadata.
It's where they were, what
where they were,
not what they said, but where they were, who they were talking
to, how long.
To,
you know, we can see the links immediately. If police think this information is good enough for them to be able to connect criminals and make, you know, full prosecutions, then it's fairly identifying information. If we're sending that overseas to China, to the States, what are we doing with that information? Who gets access to it?
Download This Show is what you are listening to, and I want you to imagine being in a cage that gets dunked underwater. You're surrounded by sea life. And in the back of your head, you know it's not real. But it's still incredibly discombobulating. That is one of the demos that you get with the new PlayStation VR. And the world finally got a good look at it at the Paris Games Week. And there was a bunch of demos. There's also one where you can walk a tightrope, which is, of course, a tie-in with the movie The Walk. Certainly, of all of the different virtual reality headsets out there, things like the Oculus Rift, PlayStation VR is the most enveloping, because not only do they use the gyros in the headset, they also use a dual camera to kind of measure where you are in the room, so it's not just what your head's doing. It's also enveloping because there's a ton of wires hanging off the back of your head while you do it. But is it exactly worth the effort? Well, we are now about to cross to the man in charge of PlayStation in Australia. On the phone with us now from Paris is Michael Ephraim.
VR has been around for close to 20 years. When I was at Sega Games, that's a lifetime ago, they had a VR demo, you know. So VR has been around for a long, long time, but now we're starting to see it really come to fruition, you know. I think what is impressing me is how quickly the creative community, being developers and publishers, are coming up with new ideas for VR in gaming with PlayStation VR.
Okay, just for you personally, what makes PlayStation VR stand out to things like the Oculus and the Vive?
I think, you know, PlayStation VR is going to focus on gaming, and I'm not sure with Oculus Rift being bought by Facebook what the applications will be. But right now, based on the opinions of others, PlayStation VR, as far as form factor, comfort, and experience, was the best that they experienced.
You're saying the focus is on gaming, but I do notice that there is a tie-in with the movie The Walk. Will Sony be taking advantage of its movie business and leveraging that on the VR platform more?
Look, we have no official news on that at all, but The Walk was a demo in VR to promote the movie. So look, we have no information right now as far as VR being used for anything else at the moment other than gaming on PlayStation.
With your experience of it so far, what are the principles behind making a game work well for PlayStation VR? There's a couple, as you mentioned, there's a couple of different genres, but I'm wondering if there's a couple of key takeaways you've seen in your experience that go, actually, these games all take really good advantage of it because they do blah.
Well, I mean, if you look at the game Heist, you're fighting the bad guys and shooting them in a car. There are two different ones. There's one in a car, and there's another one where you're in a study in a mansion behind the desk loading up your gun, and the bad guys are on the balcony and you have to shoot them. The overall fact that you're in the game will create, you know, give publishers and developers a very broad palette to create different kinds of games that will require different interaction. And then tonight to hear the announcement about Until Dawn coming out on VR, I can't wait to try that. You know, Until Dawn on its own is a great interactive horror film, and to be one of the participants in the game in the house in VR, I think is going to be pretty special.
It's interesting that you brought up Until Dawn, because Until Dawn is the VR version of it is a sort of a spin-off of the main game, Until Dawn. How important is it to get developers to really treat VR as its own platform, to kind of take best use of it?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, Shuey, our president from Worldwide Studios, did say, and I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure, that he said Until Dawn for VR was built from the ground up. It's a very different experience on VR, obviously, where you're in the game instead of, you know, viewing the game on television. So time will tell whether companies can develop a game on PlayStation and easily, or somewhat easily, port it to VR.
One of the things that's really striking about the game is that when you chuck in the other accessories, things I'm thinking about, like the Move wands, you really start to get experience that's quite distinct from the other virtual
virtual reality headsets out there. Do you think that's Sony's edge here, is the fact that they have got this broader gaming infrastructure that can really enhance the gaming experience?
Yeah, I think you've hit on a very valid point, because my understanding with Oculus, you need a keyboard, which seems counterintuitive if you're going to play a VR game. So to have the Move and the DualShock 4 controller that will work with VR, and some of them, by my understanding, just hand gesture, makes it much more accessible than my knowledge of what the other VRs offer.
Michael Ephraim there, talking to us from Paris earlier. He is, of course, the man in charge of, amongst other things, PlayStation in Australia. Welcome back to our panel, Claire Riley from CNET and Laurie Patton from Internet Australia. Both of you have used VR, but would you use this?
Absolutely. I didn't mean to sound like such a robot. I am totally a human.
It's like robot meets Valley Girl.
Yeah, absolutely. Gaming is really at the forefront of VR. I've done demos with a number of different devices now, and I've done the Shark Tank, and let me tell you, it is horrifying. I was at a launch event, sitting up on stage, doing the full immersive thing, had to throw it off, kind of leave, go and get myself a glass of wine.
It's alarming, isn't it?
It's very immersive. For people who haven't used it, it does really track your head as you move around. So you move your physical head and you are looking around underwater.
And it also, you underestimate how important sound is with this, because the sound, one of the things that they've done quite well is, as you move your head, you move around the space, they've actually shifted the sound design, which is kind of amazing. I know you've used some VR as well, Laurie. Is this something you would choose to use more often?
I think for gamers it will be the next big thing. But I think there are a whole range of other uses for virtual reality, and I've been looking at it in terms of training, occupational health and safety. There's a really cool example being developed at the moment for post-traumatic stress disorder. People with phobias, you can introduce people to the spiders.
The underwater shark tank.
Shark tank is one of those. So I think so, but it's like a lot of things. Will it be 3D and will it be a fad? And the question will be, can they get the technology usable? You know, it's cable. It's almost like being in intensive care, the amount of cabling you've got coming from you, and it's not exactly light.
But that's the thing. There's a real shift, because you can try out Oculus and you can be plugged into what feels like your own little personal defibrillator. Mm. Or you
can
use
colostomy bags.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's avoid that.
Very.
A Google Cardboard, which is just a little fold up Google. Yeah. But when they introduced that at Google I/O, everyone thought it was a joke. It was like, okay, Google, this is cardboard. No, what? It's a little fold up cardboard box, and you stick a phone inside, and it creates a pretty amazing VR experience.
Yes. And a more advanced version of that is the Samsung Gear VR, which is actually kind of it's a co-pro with Oculus, and they do, and it's kind of amazing. And I will say, Oculus as the company that I think probably you can safely say have driven this drive into VR in the last couple of years. They were a Kickstarter that came good, really. But what's interesting about Oculus as a company is they're also really stretching the definitions of what people can do with VR. PlayStation have been very clear that this is they're only interested in this as a gaming environment at the moment, whereas Oculus, they've poached an animator from Pixar who's making, adorable Pixar-style movies in a virtual environment. In terms of other uses of virtual reality, are there things that stand out to you, Claire, that are particularly interesting?
You're going to see stuff like sports. A lot of this stuff is led by sports. Let's not lie, there's probably going to be some pornography in there that's going to lead this. I think the really interesting thing with virtual reality is not so much virtual reality, the fully immersive, like, helmet on your head. I think the future will be augmented reality. And that's where you take elements of virtual reality, so digital projections, but it kind of ties in with what you're seeing in the real world. So I could be in my living room and I could be looking at my my dining table, and I could have a game of Minecraft going on top of the dining table, and I'm controlling different elements of the game, and it's utilizing things in the real space. So
it's also a little bit less antisocial.
Something
I was watching, but I did a hands-on with the PlayStation VR on my TV show last night, and I just remember watching back the footage going, I can't see myself doing this in my lounge room. All I can visualize is me walking into walls, because it's such a spatial environment. I could just imagine walking into walls. And also there's nothing fun about watching somebody else.
I saw that trailer, Mark, and you did look like a bit of a numpty. I wasn't going to tell you.
Well, I actually am a numpty, so that's fine. But whereas with AR, because you're still interacting with the real world, because you're still making eye contact with the real world, maybe it's less weird. I don't know.
I think there's a lot of applications in training and occupational health and safety and things like that where you want to be able to show people what it's like to walk past the blast furnace, but you don't want to take them to the blast furnace or you don't want to take every new employee out and do a field trip. You can do it with one and then they can sit and watch it. And, of course, the amount of technology on their head's not going to matter to them because it's part of what they're being paid to do.
Yeah, I think real estate.
Real estate is a really big one, actually.
Interior decorating. You just suddenly overlay the panels of, like, this is what your new veneers on the kitchen cabinetry will look like. Fling. And that's augmented reality.
I think so. I think that already you're seeing real estate agents. You go on the web and they've got pictures of it. But if you can actually take people out there in an augmented style and show them, and you know, you could probably change furniture and do all sorts of things that will allow you to see what it would be like with your furniture.
Well, YouTube have also recently been pushing into using 3D video. So I think the rock band Foals have a 3D video. I know the Opera House in Sydney have been filming some of their concerts in 3D. It doesn't seem like a massive leap to me to be able to layer those two bits of technology on top of each other and interact with, you know, a performance at the forecourt of the Opera House with VR. Mm. To me, that seems like such a no-brainer.
People think that VR and AR, well, VR especially, is just going to be for these weird people in a Blade Runner-esque future, just sitting in the corner of the room, not engaging with society anymore. But I really think we'll see it in very mainstream applications, and I think augmented reality as well will see it. So overlaying something, the Opera House, maybe doing a cool art installation where you walk through the space and the artworks appear there for you, or you can watch a hologram-like performance in the forecourt, but the person's not actually there. So you could be streaming that from somewhere else potentially in the future. I mean, we've seen with Microsoft HoloLens, which is an augmented reality device. I know at my work, that is what everyone is so excited about. We will pay whatever it takes to get that in our office. But the really basic demos they've done have just blown us out of the water. And it's very cool because it's not this fake 3D world that you dive into. It's your own world, but a little bit better.
All right, we have run out of time. A very big thank you to our panel this week. Claire Riley from CNET, thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And Laurie Patton from Internet Australia. Wasn't too traumatic?
It's been it's been great.
That was not at all convincing. We'll coerce him back.
It's been fabulous, thank you.
And of course, as always, my name is Mark Fennell, and thank you for listening to another episode of Download This Show.